Okay, we'll pick up where we left off last week, and we were in the 18th chapter of 1 Kings, and we were just getting to the discussion of the priest of Baal and their confrontation with Elijah. What I want to do tonight, toward the end of class, I've got another handout that I want to give out. I'm not going to discuss the handout tonight. I want to give you a chance to look at it first. And then when we come back on Sunday, Lord willing, we'll just briefly review some things in that handout with some comments from a portion of the lesson that brought the handout up. We just started talking on this last week when we stopped, so we really didn't get into the subject. So before we do bring up this subject, does anybody have any comment or question they'd like to make over things that we've already discussed? Okay. We said last week that Elijah had felt he was alone from verse 22 of chapter 18, but we know that he's not. Obadiah hit 100 prophets, and also Lord told him later that he had 7,000 people that had not bowed down to Baal. But let's move on now and talk about what happened at this event. I think everybody knows the event itself. Elijah laid out the arrangement. Each one between Elijah as one and these false prophets as another were to have an animal, a bull. And the false prophets were going to do first. They were going to build a sacrifice, and then they were going to call on fire from heaven to heat up, to cook their sacrifice. And then Elijah was going to do the same. And then whichever God answered would be the God. So let me ask you this. As you read what these false priests did, would you say that they were sincere or not sincere? What did they do that shows that sincerity? Okay. And, will someone get a copy from the back and give to them on the back row? Okay. All right. So, well, that's ultimately what they did. They started out, with prayer, calling on him for how long a period of time? Calling on Baal.
Half a day?
Yeah, half a day, from morning to noon. They were raising their voices up into him. Okay. And they were, in some way, my version says limping around the altar. In some way they were, you know, prating around the altar, seeking to, as a part of their, you know, approach to this false God. And then in verse 27, what does Elijah do? Yeah. Now remember, they attributed to these false gods the attributes that humans have, you see. So it wouldn't be out of line for their God to be thought of as having to do the things of life that humans do. So he says, cry loud. I mean, you know, he may be entertaining himself. He may be, you know, relieving himself, the restroom, or maybe he's gone, or maybe he's sleeping. These are things that people do, you see. So he just may be busy doing the stuff that people do. And, and then after this, as John said, you know, they cried aloud and cut themselves with their swords and lances until the blood gushed out. Yeah. That's done today. That's done today. Yeah.
What was the motive behind that? I mean, was it to get their God? Was it desperation? Or what do you
Well, I would say in this case, it appears to be, you know, desperation because it was the last thing. They'd spent several hours already. But, you know, I think we referred to earlier in the class to Colossians 2. We're talking about angels at that point. But the close of Colossians 2 also warns against, you know, things done to the body, you see, as a means of religiousness, you see. Yes. Right. Same thing. Yeah. So this was a part of their practice with this God, but it wasn't what they did first. And, it may have been, you know, a stronger appeal. But, so certainly they were expressing, you know, a belief in this false idol to act. Now, can a strong belief be void of substance? Be void. You know, can there be nothing behind it? Okay. So, our faith is to be built on something. When we look at passages in Hebrews 11, other places in the scripture that talk about our faith, it's established on something. Of course, we're all familiar with Romans 10, you know, how faith is established. But our faith is built upon something. And we don't mind if someone challenges our faith, as long as they give us opportunity to explain what our faith is based upon. We're not going to say, certainly I hope we're not going to say, that it's on something subjective, or it's on something that we can't explain, or something of that nature. Because you see those signs up, you know, better experienced than explained. I would hope that all of us could explain the basis of our faith. Well, faith, though, doesn't have to have a basis. Theirs does not, you see. So we understand the story. We understand what Elijah did as he himself took over, and then in verse 36 he says, at the time of the offering of the oblation, Elijah the prophet came near and said, "O Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and I have done all these things at your word." You see, at the doing of his word. When Elijah, he had built the altar, he had put the wood upon the altar, he had poured the water upon the altar, and then he asked God to accept this altar and to bring fire upon it. He says in verse 7, "Answer me that this people may know that you are, O Lord, our God, and that you have turned their hearts back." In other words, use this to cause them to see who you are and to turn back to you. And it would come through the faith that Elijah had in building this altar and acting upon it. So how did this end? And what was the end of the event? What did I say again, Jim? Okay, fire from heaven consumed it. Okay, John?
I was just saying for those Baal prophecies, ended pretty bad.
Okay, all right. Okay, now, and John brings up a little small point. It says in verse 40, it says, "Seize the prophets of Baal, or let none of them escape." And so that's 450 prophets. Some ask about the prophets of Asherah, the 400 prophets, were they killed also? I personally think yes. It says prophets of Baal. I tend to think that's included for all, but it may not be. But certainly, you know, those prophets were killed, and the people had a part on it. Notice in verse 39, "The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God," are the words of people used, and that's what Elijah had asked for in verse 37. and that you have turned your hearts back. So, this event was a direct, I'll use the word expression, slap in the face of Jezebel and the religion that she brought into the people, to the religion that had basically been set up as the national religion of Israel, the religion of the royal family. And certainly this event was something that showed directly how God disapproved of that religion and the power that he had, which Baal did not have. Any comment or question on this before we go on? Now, as you can imagine, this event is going to draw the anger of Jezebel. And we'll get into that in a little bit later. I want you to notice next, though, what's in verses 41 through 46. And this is now the second time that Elijah goes to see Ahab. And, maybe it's the third time. Yeah, I think it is. Anyway, he says, go up and eat, for there's a sound of rushing rain. This is Elijah to Ahab. And he tells him that rain is going to come. Well, it doesn't come at this point, but he's preparing for it. But it goes on into 19. And we see the anger now of Jezebel. Notice what it says in verse 2. She sent a messenger to Elijah. May the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life as one of them by this time tomorrow. How did this affect Elijah? I'm sorry? He was afraid and he ran. Okay. Now, he knew Jezebel well enough to know that she was serious. This was not, you know, idle threat on her part. And so, he ran. And it says in verse 3, he was afraid, he arose and ran for his life. And where did he go? Okay. Now, it says that he went on a day's journey and he came down and sat under a broom tree. Some say that's a juniper tree. And what did he ask for? He asked to die. Okay. I've got a handout that I want you to take a look at. And it's a handout that is just a rough comparison between Elijah and John the Baptist. Now, both of these men were recognized as good servants of God. How was Elijah recognized in the New Testament? At the Transfiguration with Moses and Jesus. How did Jesus recognize John the Baptist? No greater man was born of woman. Both of these were recognized by Jesus. And we read that John came in whose spirit? Elijah's spirit. So there's some parallels that can be drawn between these two people. So looking on your handout, I've annotated some of these comparisons. And the one I want to call your attention to is the second trait, the weakness of faith or discouragement. Now, over on the right side, I've got passages, 1 Kings 19, 1 through 4. If you'll take your pencil or pen and change the verse 4 to verse 18 and make it 1 Kings 19, 1 through 18. But both of these men were strong in faith. Both of these men led an austere life. both of them showed boldness in their life before kings. But both of these men also suffered from discouragement. And that's the part there that I want us to key on there. So you can take this handout and read it as you wish, but that's the point that I want us to think about right now as we go through the next several verses and spend the next several minutes.
What was that verse you said?
Change it from verse ending in verse 4 to ending in verse 18. That'd be, let me find it back again. Yeah, 1 Kings 19, 1 through 18. Yeah, to get a better context, okay? All right. So an angel comes and tends to him, brings him bread and water to drink, and this happens twice. And then he arose from that, and he goes to Mount Horeb for 40 days and 40 nights. And it says in my version, he goes on the strength of that food. I don't know if in those 40 days and 40 nights he had anything to eat during that time or if he was just going to Mount Horeb on the strength of that food and had food and water to eat later. But he comes to a cave. What happens? What is said to him when he gets to this cave? No. What are you doing here? Now, I want us to think about something with Elijah. When the drought first came and he went east of Jordan by the brook, what led him to go there? God. God told him to go. When he went over to the coast of the Mediterranean, the area of the Sidonians, Zarephath, why did he go there?
God sent him.
Now he's fled from Jezebel. Who told him to do that?
His fear.
God didn't tell him to. So now he's fled. He's despondent. He's discouraged. And God says to him, what are you doing here? What God is saying to him is you have no business here. This is not where you're to be. What was Elijah's response? That's right. Yeah, he's by himself. He said, let me find the page again where I was. He said, the people have forsaken your covenant. Well, that's true. He says, they've thrown down your altars, and that's true. They've killed your prophets. That's true. He says, even I, only I am left, and they seek my life to take it away. Well, it's not true that he was the only one that's left. But that's what happens to a person when he becomes despondent. He thinks he's alone. He thinks there's nobody else with him. And so this tremendous discouragement is overwhelming. And so God does three things. And these things are hard for us to comprehend. But he tells Elijah to look, and he sends a great wind, so great that it tears up big rocks out of the mountain. And then he sends an earthquake, and then he sends a fire. But it says that God was not in any of these things. And then it says again, it says, there comes a voice saying, again, what are you doing here? Now what's his response? Is it different? When Jesus said to John, after his resurrection, and the disciples had gone fishing, and Jesus is on the shore. He asked a question to Peter three times. He's trying to elicit a response. He's trying to make him think. And I would suggest that's what's happening here. He's trying to make Elijah think. He shows him these three great wonders. But sometimes God doesn't always work in great wonders. And in this case, he's telling Elijah, I need you to do what I've got for you to do. It's interesting when you look at the work of Elisha and compare it with the work of Elijah. We see some differences. We don't see the direct, harsh confrontation with the kings. Elisha had discussion with kings. Don't get me wrong. But we don't see the direct confrontation like Elijah had with Ahab. And perhaps it is that God sees this, which Elijah doesn't see, and knows that the nature of Elijah's work would change. I don't know. But it's interesting, you know, that God says the second time, what are you doing here, Elijah? He says this in a voice that couldn't be heard, you see, over the tumultuous events that just happened, the wind and the earthquake and the fire. But Elijah gives the exact same answer. He says, I've been faithful, but I'm alone. They've torn down your altars. They've killed your prophets. And even I, only I am left. And they seek my life. And not that God didn't know this. But I view it as an opportunity for Elijah to gather himself and realize just who it is that he serves. But I think Elijah felt beat. He felt that he couldn't do what God had been asking him to do. And so God says in verse 15, go return on your way to the wood unto Damascus. When you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. And Jehu the son of Nimshi you shall anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha the son of Shaphat of Bel-Mohala you shall anoint to be prophet in your place. And the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael shall Jehu put to death, and the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha put to death. Yet I will leave 7,000 Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. Before we go on in this portion of the study, does anybody have any comment or question? I want us to think about ourselves and think about in our own lives the power of despondency and discouragement. It is a tremendous force that works against us in our service to God. It's a tremendous force that works against our faith. But I think sometimes it's one that we allow to overwhelm us. And it will get us down. It will take a grip on us before we really realize what's happened to us. And things can be discouraging, different things to different people. Some people can be discouraged rather easily. But there's a big antidote to discouragement. Don't turn there, but in John chapter 7, beginning in verse 37, Jesus cries out, and he's pleading with the people to believe who he is. And he cries out, and there's kind of a sense of urgency, of pleading in his voice. And you remember in Matthew 23, this was after Jesus had denounced the woes upon the Pharisees. And then on the city of Jerusalem, he says, how often would I have gathered you and you would not? You see, talking about, you know, as a chicken gathers the wings, you see, Jesus, you know, could have come discouraged. But Jesus knew the plan of God. And knowing God's plan is a powerful factor in fighting discouragement. In other words, Elijah didn't know God's plan. All the prophets of the Old Testament had a handicap in not knowing. Peter wrote how the prophets of long ago, you know, wanted to know about this plan of God, but it wasn't to be revealed to them. We know the plan. We know God's plan. And because we know what God has in store for us, there should be no discouragement that can overwhelm us. We just have to keep the faith. We have to be able to live through the things that come our way and understand that God's working is going to prevail. Imagine the people in the days of the Revelation letter that John wrote. Imagine the discouragement. Imagine how they felt that the emperor was going to win and that their faith was empty, a void faith, like the faith of those men who believed in Baal, a faith that was not going to hold true under the constant persecution of the Roman government. And so the letter's written to give them the hope and the courage and the understanding of what's going to happen. We have all that. We have it. So let's not become a victim of despondency and discourage. Any comment? Yeah, the focus would be part of it. Yeah. That would be part of it. I think so. Any other comment? Jim? Talk louder.
It's not too difficult to get down on Elijah and what he did or didn't do. Lack of courage. We did the same then. They did the same thing when the Lord was on the earth. He walked the earth and he did something when he did miracles. When people saw him, rose to be great, and they still became despondent. They still became discouraged, even his own disciples. So, it shouldn't surprise us that, you know, he's an example, but we do have, as you said,
Jim is saying that even the Lord's disciples became discouraged, and they were with him. Certainly, as I brought out on that paper, John the Baptist became discouraged. Again, John didn't have the full picture of what was happening and suffered from discouragement. Remember, he was in prison and he sent to Jesus to ask him, are you the one or should we look for another? That was the same John that would said, behold, the Lamb of God takes away the sins of the world. Same man. See, what happened? You see, he wasn't seeing his perception of the kingdom take place. And thus the question, are you the one, or should we look for another? So, it happens. It happened among the disciples. But it doesn't have to happen to us. Any other comment? John?
I kind of always wondered about Elijah when he said that, you know, he felt alone. You know, Obadiah told him that about the prophecy. And I always wondered, did he just not believe Obadiah? But even if so, you know, he just turned some of people's hearts as it appeared anyway. you know, back to God at nothing else but what they said. But, of course, now, you know, it looks short to us, just a short time period to read. And just a little later, he's running away from Jezebel. Of course, then I wonder, too, he's always dealt with Ahab. Looked like he knew who really the driving force was. It was Jezebel behind that. But I've always wondered if he really believed he was alone or if this was just his answer now, you know, in his fear and all these things make sense.
Well, again, it's what I'll go back to what I said a few minutes ago. I think that comes out of fear and despondency and discouragement. We fail to see the help. How many people get discouraged and fail to utilize the assembly, their brethren? They think they're alone. I've got to figure this out for myself, and I can't figure it out. It's bigger than I am. So what happens? They quit praying, and they quit attending, you see. They isolate, okay? Elijah fleeing for his life. I mean, that's the reason he isolated himself. He was running. But again, but this is what we do because we allow this despondency and discouragement to overwhelm us. Now, again, we can go back to Hebrews. Let's just go ahead and turn there and read it. Hebrews chapter 10. And perhaps it's a, you know, give us an insight as to what this verse is saying. But it's a verse that we know, we know, we know. Look in verse 24. Well, let's begin in 23. Hebrews 10, verse 23. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering. You see, despondency and discouragement causes us to waver. See, that hope, you know, is kind of watered down. You see, it's not as strong. And he says, for he who promised is faithful. So the issue with the wavering hope is not because God has changed. It's because we've changed. And so then he says in 24, and let us consider how to stir up one another, provoke one another, stimulate one another to love and good works. So, verse 25, not neglecting to meet together is a habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. So this idea of stimulation, this idea of encouragement, you see, this is part of God's plan in this local assembly. It's part of God's plan when he says to prefer one another versus preferring to be around the people of the world. See, preferring one another, spending our time together, come together to worship him, is part of God's plan to help us overcome these things that bite us in life and cause us to be discouraged. There's nothing that happens to any of us that's unique to us. In some sense or another, we all experience, you know, something similar. It's what Jesus said about himself. And so something similar would be true for us. Yeah.
So I have a question regarding what this verse is really connotating.
Which verse? Hebrews?
Hebrews.
Okay. I think it's stronger than apostasy. I think it's definitely stronger than that. The wording around that doesn't support just the concept of apostasy.
And the reason I think that, now I'm just asking because of verse 26, we go on sinning deliberately. Somebody who maybe misses every now and then can't really say that it's deliberate in terms of, well, you know, they miss every now and then. They probably know what they're doing more so, but somebody who doesn't come any service whatsoever, I think of more, that's the sinning deliberately. So that's why I kind of wonder if that's about apostasy, somebody who's just completely lost, or if it's somebody that's been discouraged, so they're not coming, but they start coming in because the brethren start reaching out.
I don't know where any sin that would be deliberate. And by deliberate, I mean you're looking at a choice and you choose the wrong thing. I don't look at any sin as being deliberate, that it's necessary that it also be habitual. I don't see those two things as congruent in this application. Certainly habitual would be an issue. Okay. But I don't know that it has to be habitual to, for this to apply.
I used to agree. It just didn't, you know, I've heard different things now.
Yeah.
And I'm just kind of wondering what you thought.
Anybody else have a comment? Okay. Did I answer you? Okay. All right. So we see at the close of this reading then that he's to anoint three people. And we're going to see these people at work later on having to do with the downfall of the household of Ahab. Certainly we can see in this, in verse 16, where he's to anoint, or verse 15, where he's to anoint Hazael king over Syria. We see that God's appointment over rulers of nations. In this case, we see it directly. It turns out it's Elisha that does it, but Elisha goes to Hazael and actually announces to him that he's to be the king. And this was the complete destruction that was going to fall on his house. Any question or comment before we move on? In chapter 20, Ahab has some wars with Syria under the king Ben-Hadad. And we see in these battles that Ahab never goes to God, but God sends a messenger to Ahab. In verse 7 of chapter 20, it says that the king of Israel called the elder of the land and says, what should I do? He doesn't go to God. He goes to the elders of the land. Well, that's better than Rehoboam did. Rehoboam went to the young men. But he's not going to God. Now, in the verses preceding this, we can see something about Ahab that to me shows the kind of person he is. What was it that Ahab said he was coming after, that he wanted? I'm not Ahab, but that Ben-Hadad said that he wanted from Ahab. His wives and children. And what did Ahab say? Okay. You know, not willing, you know, to even put up even a verbal battle for his wives and children. So to me, this speaks of a man that's cowardly, that has no thought for anybody else but himself. And, of course, we know from the reading that the messenger came back and said, well, we're going to go through your houses and search. And then he bowed his back and he goes to the elders. And so a war comes. They're to have a battle. And a prophet comes to Ahab in verse 13. It says, have you seen all this great multitude? Behold, I will give it into your hand. For what reason? For what reason? To know that I am the Lord. You see, God is going to present himself to Ahab such that Ahab will know assuredly that he's God. When a man is condemned before God, that man is going to know assuredly that he's condemned. There's people that's going to say, oh Lord, did we not do this and do that, as Matthew 7 talks about. But they're going to know. They're going to know. Ahab, if he chooses to reject God after what God is going to do for him, then then Ahab will have made these choices fully aware of who the God of Israel is and what his power is. And so how is it that this army is defeated this time, the Syrian army? What happens that they're defeated? Is it that tough a question? First off, they get drunk. Okay? Now, this says to me they didn't take it very seriously. They thought they would be rather easily wipe out the city. But then God tells them to pick, this prophet tells them to pick 232 men that are servants of the governors of the districts. Or that's how many he picked out. Now these were not the fighting force. These were not valiant men. So what is this going to tell Ahab when these 232 men lead that small army of 7,000? Gideon led how many men? Yeah. Gideon led 300, you know. He's leading 232 that are not warriors. And so they go and as the story says, it's told Ben-Hadad that these men are approaching, and it basically says, bring them in alive. No matter if they're coming for war, if they're coming for not, bring them in alive. And again, I gave you the handout on drinking. And this is another example I put on there. And this is a king, Ben-Hadad. And perhaps the drinking was affecting his judgment, you know, as a king. And so I'll leave that for you to look at and think about, along with the other things that's on that handout on alcohol. But
you asked about the proving that he was the Lord.
I'm sorry?
You mentioned that this would prove that God is the Lord to these people, which is certainly true, but the size of the army. One remarkable thing is that the prophet told him what would happen before it happened.
Yes.
And it was such a it's not the kind of prophecy that you calculate things and make a good guess. There are 32 kings and chariots and horses, and in a later battle, 127,000 of their soldiers died. Now you're going to take 232 leaders and 7,000 men and you're going to whip them. For that man to say that before it happened, that's putting his prophecy on the line. But the same Moses did the same thing. God appeared to him in the bush and said, well, tell the people what I'm going to do. And then you're going to worship God on this mountain. So then Moses and Aaron will tell the elders. The elders tell the people all that before it happened. Now that's proving that a prophet is speaking by higher power.
Right. Good point. So the Assyrians fled, and King of Israel says, struck him with a great blow. Then the prophet says to the King of Israel, comes to him a second time, he says, consider what you have done, strengthen yourself, for in the spring the king of Syria will come up against you again. And the reason is, in verse 23, the servants of the king of Syria said to him, their gods are gods of the hills. In other words, the God of heaven is a God of the hills. And he says, so they're stronger than we, but let us fight against them in the plain where we're stronger than they, than the God of heaven. So now here, God hears this, of course, and God's going to react to this, and we'll take up that next week. I want to pass out a handout, if I can solicit you two guys, pass this out. And we will talk about this, you know, briefly on our class Wednesday. Here's a big one for you, okay? Who needs a large print? Just one here tonight needs a large print? Okay. All right. Any comment or question about anything that we've brought up tonight? This handout that I'm giving you is on the principles of prayer. Now, we skipped over the section tonight where Elijah goes back and where it said it was going to rain. And there's a part of that yet ahead of us, but we haven't really talked about that. We've gone past it. And I want you to think about the time when God, when Elijah told Ahab that it was not going to rain, and then later Elijah tells Ahab that it is going to rain. And I want you to think about that in terms of James chapter 5, where it talks about the prayers of Elijah. Okay? And so we're going to talk a little bit, not necessarily a great bit of time. We'll talk about that in connection with James 5 in the class on Sunday, Lord willing. And Sunday we'll finish this handout, and then we'll go to the next class, to the next study. Thank you.